today on Edinburgh Radio News.
Can't mail one in. It's something that you had to do online. Right now, we can't even see our applications to work on them.
Applications for low-power FM stations are on hold with the government shutdown. Good afternoon from the University of Southern California, and welcome to Edinburgh Radio News for Tuesday, October 15th, 2013. I'm Ani Yukar. Local water officials are warning Southern Californians to cut back on water usage. The state is facing the third year of a drought. As Zhao Chen reports, some residents are taking the initiative to implement water-conserving tactics in their yards.
Mark Vaninatos lives on a hilltop in the Glassell Park neighborhood of Los Angeles. 2 years ago, he installed a system in his yard to save water. One part of it is a big barrel to reduce gray water. That's leftover water from showers and washing dishes.
So what happens is when we take a shower, turn on the sink, the water goes down into a barrel in front of our house where the gray water is kept. And once the water raises to a certain height, a float valve in it opens it up and it goes down through some piping that takes it down to drip irrigation further down the hill where we have some fruit trees.
The system also has four big tanks behind the house to capture and store rainwater.
So whenever it rains on the roofs of both houses, water comes off the roof. There's a little filter there, and it goes in these pipes, and it goes underground, and then it comes back out, and it goes into these. These are four industrial storage containers. And then when we want to water something, you just hook a hose up to it, and you can turn it on, and then you can water some plants here in the back or whatever.
Vaninatos spent more than $1,000 to install the water system. Compared to his neighbor's water bills, Vaninatos says his is below the average. He hasn't recouped his initial cost, but in the long run, he thinks it will be cost-effective to reduce water waste. Landscape designer Paul Robbins says most homeowners don't know about conserving water. He says they are using too much water in their yards.
Or I think any landscape designer's work is to save water. Of course, I'm trying to with my designs, but clients don't actually want to save water. So there's just a lot of wastage going on.
But more residents will have to learn how to save water because California is facing a serious water shortage. Some water-saving measures include growing drought-resistant plants, reducing how much you water your lawn, and using barrels to catch rainwater. Zhao Chen, Edinburgh Radio News.
As the October 17th debt ceiling deadline comes closer, U.S. stock markets have taken a stumble, another sign of the uncertainty that the Congress will reach an agreement to reopen the government. House Republicans removed two of their demands from the negotiating table, one being a repeal of taxes on medical devices included in the Affordable Care Act. And in its 15th day, the government shutdown really is affecting everyone, even us radio people. Today was supposed to be the first day that nonprofit groups could apply for a low-power radio license from the Federal Communities Commission. But the government shutdown is putting the application process on hold. Catherine Davis brings us the story.
KX93.5, Laguna's only FM.
KXRN is a non-commercial radio station in Laguna Beach, but you won't hear it on your car radio if you drive too far out of the area. KXRN is an LPFM station. LP stands for low-powered. It's an FCC-licensed station, it just doesn't broadcast very far. And that's the way KXRN founder Tyler Russell likes it.
The only other option down here is to listen to an LA station, and it just doesn't relate to where we live.
The station's FCC low-power FM license is not very common. In fact, among community radio enthusiasts, it's highly coveted. The FCC gives out very few of them. In the 1990s, station ownership restrictions were lifted. Since then, media consolidation has led to bigger and bigger stations.
Whether you're in New York City or Kansas or Philly or, you know, rural Montana, you're listening to the same radio formats. The reason community radio is so important is that it allows, you know, local organizations, you know, to reclaim the airwaves.
That's Sanjay Jolly from the Prometheus Radio Project. Groups like Prometheus have been campaigning to get the FCC to issue more LPFM licenses for 15 years. In 2011, President Obama signed the Local Community Radio Act, which paved the way for the FCC to start giving out 100-watt licenses to nonprofit commercial-free stations. That was set to begin today. The FCC was scheduled to start taking hundreds of applications for LPFM licenses from October 15th through the 29th. This was expected to be one of the biggest expansions in broadcasting in U.S. history. Only one problem.
You can't mail one in. It's something that you had to do online. Right now, we can't even see our applications to work on them.
That's Chris Randolph, director of South Philadelphia Community Radio. He was planning to apply for an FCC license. He even started an Indiegogo campaign to raise money for his station. But the government shutdown has left his station's application in limbo. Randolph sees a big need in Philadelphia for smaller stations. Large stations, he says, miss the mark sometimes.
Those are radio stations which are simply never going to have any interest whatsoever in looking at a very local political campaign or announcing your flea market, your fundraiser, your immediate school closure, your firehouse closing down.
He hopes someday his station will provide more hyper-local coverage, but it all depends on the government.
If this drags on after October 29th, we don't really know what territory we're heading into. I imagine that they would give some form of extension, and I should say that they should.
For now, Randolph and hundreds of other small startup radio stations are still waiting for their chance to get on the air. Catherine Davis, Annenberg Radio News.
Asala Sanipour contributed to that report. It's getting close to dinner time, but if you're thinking of heading over to McDonald's, you might want to think again. UC Berkeley has released a report saying fast food workers need to make more money. Fast food workers held a rally today in front of a Hollywood McDonald's, and Andy Vasoyan reports.
$8 an hour is really not cutting it no more. It's really not cutting it no more.
That's Joe Ben Johnson III, a fast food employee talking outside a crowded McDonald's near the 101 freeway. He moved to L.A. to pursue an education, but without help from his family, that dream is getting further and further out of reach.
They pay us so little that we have to rely on public food services and programs. That's not fair on the taxpayers.
How much is the taxpayer helping out, though, really? According to a joint report released today by UC Berkeley and the University of Illinois, it's definitely more than the price of a Happy Meal. The report says families of fast food workers use on average over $1 billion a year in food stamps, on top of $1.9 billion in tax credits.
And so we have a wage crisis in this country. We have a wage crisis of workers not earning livable wages.
That's Victor Navarro, who works for the UCLA Downtown Labor Center. He says the consequences of the low pay extend beyond the workers.
And they have to rely on external resources, so they have to rely on government benefits, which impacts all of us, because then we end up subsidizing the income of these workers.
Now, that wage crisis is hitting certain families harder than others, particularly those who have been working for companies for a long time.
My name is Isela Briones. I've worked at McDonald's for 6 years.
Isela Briones has four young children who count on her, two daughters and two granddaughters. She's also receiving benefits from the government, but with four dependents, she says it's not enough. Her 11-year-old daughter, Marilyn, is out marching with her. She has a lot more on her mind than your everyday fifth grader.
At times, we suffer, and like we don't have nothing to eat, and like I feel bad because my mom needs a lot of help with this.
Time will tell whether Abriola's wages will pick up enough to provide for her children, or if McDonald's and other fast food companies will turn a deaf ear. Andy Vasoyan, Annenberg Radio News.
The AIDS Healthcare Foundation made free HIV and STD testing available today in the MacArthur Park. It's part of a National Latino AIDS Awareness Day. Sarah Zahedi reports.
Dozens of Spanish-speaking residents came to MacArthur Park to get one-minute free HIV and STD tests from the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. The foundation also marked the launch of its new Latino outreach campaign. LA County officials say Latinos make up 40% of those living with HIV in the county. For this reason, Carlos Catano of the AIDS Healthcare Foundation says reaching out to the Latino community is especially important.
Many Latino people don't know their HIV status, so what we want is people to be familiar with the testing.
Catano says many Latinos in the area cannot afford health care, so it's vital that the tests are free.
It's accessible to any person. We don't charge anything because it's a right that people have.
Lined up at the testing booth, Fermin Perez Barrios and Liz Norris say they are glad this effort is reaching out to Latinos specifically.
A lot of people, they don't know. A lot of people, they don't use protections. That's a reason very important to make the test.
The community needs it, you know, especially around this area here. There's not a lot of resources for a lot of people.
Jose Lopez says the first step is education.
Old generation, they have unprotected sex a lot. We should educate our older Latino community a little more with this, and from them to educate the little kids.
The AIDS Healthcare Foundation encourages the community to learn of future testing opportunities and get more information at freehivtest.net. Sarah Zahedi, Annenberg Radio News.
Tonight, things are expected to get chilly with a low of 59, but expected to warm up tomorrow with a high of 86, while cooling down a bit on Thursday with a high of 78. Later on Annenberg Radio News, South LA businesses band together to save a community theater. Like any good relative, Alberto Ishida is going to the airport to pick up his cousin. There's just one problem. He's never met him and doesn't know what he looks like. Emmanuel Martinez takes us on the search for Shingo Nakajima.
My name is Alberto Ishida, and today I'm going to LAX to pick up my third cousin. And this is the first time I will have ever met him. What do you think the best place to be would be? I don't know how to describe his features. Soft, I guess? I don't know if that's a feature of a feature. Soft features. That could be Shingo. No? Maybe? Nope, it's not him. For some reason, I feel like it's either going to be we're not like each other at all, or we're freakishly similar, and I'm not going to like him. Maybe that's it. I feel like that could have been him. He's maybe like 5'10", so taller than me. Brown skin, maybe similar color that I am, more of like a bronze. And short hair. I think he would be skinny in terms of body weight. That guy, that's him, I think. Let's see.
I'm Shingo Nakajima, and I come from Japan, Tokyo. We're cousins, but I think technically he's my third cousin.
Oh, Shingo. How's it going, man?
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
We are are now joined by Sophia Vicklin, principal at Backcode, a company that develops serious game strategies for the classroom and employee education, to hear what she has to say about women in the male-dominated tech world.
Thank you.
Can you tell us what's happening with women in the field of technology?
The trend right now is to try to get more women into the STEM careers, and I think it's really positive, and the numbers increased drastically over the past decade.
Why do you think that is?
I think that women are more optimistic about the career prospects than before, and there is more acceptance of women being in technology. There is more understanding of the phenomena of them being in traditionally male-dominated environments. So a lot of work has been laid out by pioneering women who had careers in computer science and engineering.
What advice do you have for women trying to enter the workforce?
I think as women, we always expect others to have faith in us and somehow give us validation. And the biggest piece of advice I could give women, young girls, and basically everybody who's trying to change careers into STEM field from other industries is validation is neither desired or required. So basically validate yourself and believe that you could do it.
What was one of the biggest challenges you've faced?
The biggest challenges that I faced were, I had a number of businesses throughout my life. Backcode is my fourth company. And I had multiple companies before that. It's basically to having to, say, close a business if it didn't work out. And that was the most painful experience because a lot of times you wanted to succeed. And that's another piece of advice that I could give to younger audiences, that you will have failures and it's totally okay to fail. And you should be proud of it because it serves as a great experience for the future and it does not define you as a person, and you may start again and you must start again and try. And every time you gain more momentum, more power, more opportunity. So basically it's like climbing a mountain.
We've been speaking with Sophia Vicklin, principal at Backcode. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me here.
A planned metro stop in Lemaire Park has drawn the attention of several investors. They've already bought a cluster of businesses and cultural establishments on Degnan Boulevard and 43rd Street. Many in Lemaire Park say the commercialization could be the end of the historic African-American cultural hub. Brianna Sachs has the story.
Virginia, help us out. And Zynga Kimbrough opens her shop, Zambezi Bazaar, on Degnan Boulevard in Lemaire Park, much like she has for the past 22 years. But lately, she has trouble seeing the point.
Okay, at first it was great, it was fun and events, and we were looking toward, a positive future. But it's over, it's dead.
Like Kimbrough's shop, many of the neighborhood's businesses sell African art, books, antiques, and clothing. It's become a retail and cultural hub for the African American community for over 20 years.
All up and down the street were galleries, the African galleries, paint stores, and the owners will tell you about that.
Resident Kolsom Abtar says this is what Lemaire Park is known for. But Kimbrough and many other businesses in the area have been struggling for a long time.
Drowning in an ocean of, I gotta pay the rent.
The Metro's new Lemaire Park Metro stop seemed like it could turn things around and infuse more life into the fading shops and empty streets. But business owner Laura Hendricks says investors are coming in, snapping up properties, and threatening to kick them out.
The property across from me, which is 7 or 8 units, that's been sold.
About a dozen businesses have been purchased by investment companies MBA Mascot and West 43rd Place. The businesses have not met or even been contacted by their new owners, but received written notifications to pay a higher month-to-month rent or leave. I drove to the listed address for MBA Mascot in Culver City, but no business by that name was listed. The building manager had never heard of it, and no other information is available on these companies. Gallery Plus art store owner Hendricks has been here for nearly 30 years and says the neighborhood is an important landmark for LA.
I feel that we're threatened because we don't know what the future looks like for us. We're on edge. Looks like a sign of gentrification. This is a cultural area and we would like to keep it as that.
She says Lemaire Park should be preserved by the city, though it may be too late for that. Brianna Sachs, Annenberg Radio News.
Digital privacy may be the biggest political issue of our time. And while Hollywood's new take on the topic surprisingly understated, that doesn't stop the movie The Fifth Estate from being a bit of a mess. Angie Sutton has a preview of the film, which will be released in theaters later this week.
Man is least himself when he talks in his own person. But if you give him a mask, he will tell you the truth.
The film The Fifth Estate is a bit about the underdog, but who exactly that underdog is remains to be seen. Is it Julian Assange, played by Benedict Cumberbatch, for reporting what he believes needs to be reported regardless of who it may hurt? Or is it Daniel Domscheit-Berg, played by Daniel Brühl, for finally saying enough and wanting Assange to be as transparent as WikiLeaks itself? The story is about Assange and the rise of the WikiLeaks website. For the most part, the plot is fast-moving. We meet the two men as they first meet each other and see Domscheit-Berg's character tempted into becoming a volunteer for Assange.
Two people and a secret. The beginning of all conspiracy. More people and more secrets. But if we could find one moral man, one whistleblower, someone willing to expose those secrets, that man could topple the most powerful and most repressive of regimes.
So says Assange, little realizing that this could very well hold true for his own organization. The story ends up being about the secrets of Assange himself. While the movie is being promoted as Cumberbatch's movie, and while Cumberbatch is, unsurprisingly, very good in it, the movie actually belongs to Brühl. It's always the sidekick who does the most work, after all, and Brühl shines in his portrayal of a man who believes fully in the cause, even when he's not entirely sure what the true meaning of that cause is. It's an understated performance. Brühl shows the ongoing conflict that Domscheit-Berg goes through as he learns and relearns what little truth about Assange he can. It's a telling sign that we hear at least three different reasons as to why Assange's hair is white, and with each telling, Brühl shows that his character is taking notice. Assange is all about transparency, apparently, for everyone but him. The movie is filmed in the stereotypical faux documentary style, handheld camera angles at the ready. Thankfully, it's a bit dampened, making it mostly palpable, and director Bill Condon makes the interesting directorial decision to use actual news footage, but never using any footage of Assange himself. While I hadn't been that keen on seeing a movie based on Assange, the trailer had sold me. While the movie is well done, I feel the trailer overpromises. The movie is about a half hour too long, and there are too many subplots that muddle the main story arc.
If you want the truth, you should seek it out for yourself. That's what they're afraid of. You.
Whether this is the true story of the origin of the classified media publishing platform and the main forces behind it remains to be seen. The posters ask, hero or traitor, you decide. What it doesn't specify is who they are talking about, Assange or Domscheit-Berg. The movie makes a valid case for either. The Fifth Estate opens nationwide October 18th. This is Angie Fiedler-Sutton, Annenberg Radio News.
The concept of photoetry, the artistic combination of photography and poetry, was born 8 years ago when two college students attended an art gallery downtown. Nearly a decade later, a local poet has published a collection of poems inspired by South Central Los Angeles. Anna Catherine Brigida has the story.
Poet Hiram Sims moved all around Los Angeles growing up, but he always felt a connection to South Central. That's where he went to school, and that's where he felt a sense of community.
As soon as I became able to choose where I lived, that's when I moved to South Central.
This influenced his just-published book, Photoetry, Poetry and Photography from South Central LA.
So I felt that with my poetry, I could express the humanity of my community. And I often describe photoetry as a testament to the humanity of my community.
Sims teamed up with five local photographers to create the book. He gave them 50 poems to evoke an image. In turn, the photographers gave Sims pictures as inspiration. The result was a collection of poems, each on a stark white page, paired with a vibrant, emotional, or thought-provoking picture.
The chief job of a poet is to create imagery in the mind of the reader, or express the imagery we see in our own mind.
Poet Phyllis Wheatley was able to do this through her poetry. The first poem in Sims' book is dedicated to the slave who won her freedom through her work. Sims' other poems explore issues of race, violence, and religion. The book is available for sale through Figueroa Press. Anna Catherine Brigida, Annenberg Radio News.
The Dodgers face off tonight against the Cardinals in hopes of tying up the National League championship. The Dodgers shut out the Cardinals last night to get their first win of the series. Victor Figueroa has more on what's going on in sports.
The turning point in the Dodgers' victory came in the fourth inning when Yasiel Puig hit a triple off the wall to bring in Adrian Gonzalez. The hit was the first for Puig in the series after going hitless for 10 at-bats. Puig initially thought he hit a home run, but even after realizing his mistake, the Cuban sensation still gave a little celebratory strut and delivered a couple of passionate air punches on his way to third. When asked about Puig's triple celebration, manager Don Mattingly said, "That's just Yasiel." The San Diego Chargers quieted Colts fans about their much-hyped and highly favored Andrew Luck offense. They defeated the Colts 19-9. Of course, Andrew Luck barely saw the field as the Chargers held the ball for 17 minutes longer than the Colts. The Chargers were hitting on all cylinders as Ryan Matthews ran for over 100 yards and rookie receiver Keenan Allen showed his moves, catching 9 passes for 107 yards. Things are looking up for the Chargers, who will face the winless Jags, while the Colts will have to do better if they hope to stand a chance against the Broncos on Sunday. Victor Figueroa, Annenberg Radio News.
Now we check in with Alex Lesnick to see what's coming up on Annenberg TV News at 6 p.m. on Trojan Vision.
Hey guys, coming up on ATVN, the city of Pasadena had Homeless Connect Day, where homeless people received medical, dental, and vision screenings. And there's going to be an update on the Roe story. USC's cracking down on frat Roe as an LMU student suffered serious injuries at a frat party. And finally, travelers are going to be discussing the dry ice explosions at LAX that took place dramatically today. Thanks, Ani, and this is going to be a very interesting night.
Yeah, we'll be sure to look for it.
All right. Thanks, guys. You have a good night.
And be sure to watch that Dodger game.
Oh, yeah. We're going to have a great time with that. Dodgers are going to be killing it tonight. It's going to be great.
Definitely.
All right.
Thanks, Alex.
No problem. Good night, guys.
A 16-panel committee is considering a proposal which would allow California community colleges to grant four-year degrees. Samantha Chu has the story.
Right now, community colleges only offer two-year degrees. The potential move to allow them to also offer bachelor degrees has stirred up some controversy. Critics worry that community colleges will depart from their mission to provide students an affordable education. However, advocates say that the move will better prepare students for the workforce. The proposal is still in its early stages and will need to be approved by the governor before any action takes place. Samantha Chu, Annenberg Radio News.
LAX increased security today while police investigate a second dry ice explosion. The latest one happened last night, bringing the total number of explosions to 4 since Sunday night. The dry ice bombs, plastic bottles containing solid dry ice, were located in restricted areas. Authorities do not suspect terrorism, but they are pursuing the matter seriously. No one was injured. This Tuesday, we had help today from Asala Sanipour and Jules Zink. A big thanks to ATVN. Graham Clark produces the arts and cultural segment, and Denise Guerra is the newscast producer. Our executive producer is Catherine Davis. For all of us here at Annenberg Radio News, I'm Ani Yukar.